Hi, this is Paul. Sometimes after I make a video, there are things that I wish I had said. And part of the reason I don't go back and re-record a video is because it's sort of the process. I make videos in order to say things, and then I have them recorded so I can go back and listen to what I said, or I jot them down because I have thoughts when I make videos. I mean, it's kind of a flow set date thing, I suppose. I record videos, and I do these videos partly because it jogs new ideas. Now, if some of you might remember, if you watched my conversation with Tripp about Mars Hill, he mentioned he had an uncle who teaches at a university, and he had written a book about the mega churches. James K. Wellman Jr. is his name, and he has a book, High on God, How Mega Churches Won the Heart of America. And, well, often if I go to bed, I like to listen to something. Almost always listening to something puts me to sleep. So I'll go to bed and I'll be listening to something, and often it'll be a podcast or an audiobook, and I set the sleep timer. And last night it was like, I didn't really feel like listening to any of the dozen books that were already on my phone, and I had some Audible credits. So went over to Audible and thought, well, I'll check out Tripp's uncle's book. And I put it in. I also fall asleep very, very quickly, so I didn't hear much of it. But when I woke up this morning, I'd heard enough that I was interested, so I backed up and I started listening again and really got into it. So you'll probably be getting some stuff out of this book, although I'm pretty fickle. I want to make a video on the Christian Reformed Church's fight over same-sex marriage. There's a lot of videos I want to make, but some stuff in this book really caught my attention. Now, this is sort of on my reflections after making, I have to be careful now because I haven't released this video that I just showed you the thumbnail to. I had to make the thumbnail quick so I could put it in this video. All depends how long this video is in terms of when I release it in some ways. But I made this video with some commentary on Chris Williamson on Rebel Wisdom talking about alternative media, because I thought there was a lot of really helpful insights into the state of the culture in that. And again in that video, I note how, in a lot of ways, what Chris is doing with his channel surrounding wisdom, and what David is doing with his channel surrounding sense making, and what John Vervaeke is doing with his effort on the religion that's not a religion, what the Stoa is doing, what all of these people are doing, very much builds on what churches have done for a very long time. Even though most of these individuals have very little church experience, what they wind up doing is very similar to what churches have been doing for a very long time. And I keep noticing that. And then when I hear Chris, Williamson talk about personal growth, I think about, okay, personal growth towards what? And that triggers, a long-standing thing that I think of all of this dead reckoning and approximation of trying to figure out what is the good and moving towards it. And whereas with Christians, well, we're moving towards Christ, we're moving towards our perfection, and all of that is deeply embedded within long religious traditions. Whereas they sort of just willfully move off some traditions and often unknowingly. Now I'm going to go off the reservation here and grab some stuff that I was thinking of this morning. Yeah, this is going to be a little longer video than I was thinking. Not real long for my videos, but Steel Man FS, linked myself and Tom Holland in a Michael Sherman video where they had some things to say about religion. And, oh, religion's going away, but probably only going away. Well, maybe I should just play the darn thing.
That last subject on religion, you published The God Delusion in 2006. And, since then, the rise of the nuns, people with no religious affiliation, has gone up quite dramatically, maybe to a certain extent, the influence of your work, but that of maybe the secular movement in general has had some influence. But in any case, if the trend lines continue, do you think it possible that religion will simply fall into disuse or be replaced by secular institutions? Do we even need to replace it? I mean, is it, you know, Paul Kurtz had this idea, well, we need to build a secular, the equivalent of a secular church in every city where you can get buried and married and, you know, so forth. And but I'm not sure about that.
I'm not either. It's a separate question. And I know many people who feel very strongly we do need something like that. And they do want to set up kind of secular churches. And if they want to do that, that's fine. I don't feel the need for it myself. Will religion just go away? It might go away in Christendom, although in America I'm not so sure. But there's a huge problem of Islam. I mean, it's...
Now, pay attention to this. As Sam Harris would say, put a flag right there. May go away in Christendom. Well, maybe not America. Well, the huge problem...
A major force in the world of Islam. I mean, although in America I'm not so sure, but there's a huge problem of Islam. I mean, it's a major force in the world of benighted ignorance. There are beginnings of signs. I hear sort of rumblings from Iran and from Egypt and Iraq. That things may be beginning to shift, but we've got a long way to go there. You know, the translation project that my foundation is running, translating books, yeah, for example, mine and others, into the languages of Islam, into Arabic and Farsi and Urdu and Indonesian. And there's big take-up for them. The God Delusion has been translated millions of times. Sorry, has been downloaded millions of times as a PDF translation into Arabic.
They're very evangelistic, as they're very evangelical in many ways.
And that's a very encouraging.
And in fact, that's Michael Sherman's word for the video, Richard Dawkins on evangelizing.
Sign. There's a sort of beginning to be a shift there, I think. In Christendom, it looks to me as though things are going in the right direction quite a significant way, as you say. The rise of the nuns.
Okay. In Christendom. Now, these are scientists. They believe in logic. You sort of do little A-B testing on things.
Certainly in Northern Europe, but now in America. You know, I mean, evangelicals, and not to mention Catholics, are wringing their hands about, you know, losing members. To which I say, well, good. But, you know, in their worldview, well, that means the kind of decline of moral standards and values. But really, I think, you know, we've developed a pretty good system of secular values with a foundation of why certain things are right and wrong, again, based on human suffering and other criteria, you know, that...
It's the science, really.
Oh, our values come from science. This is exactly why this guy linked Tom Holland and myself in this video.
So, and as for the idea that we either get our morals from religion or should get them from religion, it's such a horrific idea. Whatever.
I guess it's horrible because it's true.
Where else we get them from? We do not and should not get them from religion.
Where exactly do we get them from? Now, remember, they just made the point that this worldview that they're so excited about is really only taking place in Christendom. Why isn't it taking place everywhere? Does Iran not do science? Why are we worried about them refining nuclear material? Does China not do science? Does the Islamic world not do science? I mean, they've set up a case, and now they're denying the most obvious fact of the case.
Well, right. This week or last week with the fall of Afghanistan, you know, there's all this discussion about, well, hopefully the Taliban will adopt a new reading or understanding of, you know, women's rights and Sharia law and so on. It's like,
this is not the direction we can go.
Because, you know, just hope they read it the right way. You know, what right way?
Quite, yes, quite.
I mean, unless Islam has an enlightenment like Christianity did, where they went through the enlightenment and they became much more liberal. Slowly, you know, the abolition of slavery and civil rights, women's rights, gay rights, and so on, Christendom has gotten behind those movements, albeit late in the game and slow.
Well, who did it first? Where is this group of medieval atheists that did it first, and then the Christians learned it from them somewhere in Europe? Atlantis? Did they drop below the sea? You know, do these guys pay any attention to history?
Slowly, but they got there, you know, because they're modern people that live in an Enlightenment-influenced culture. But the problem is Islam never went through something like an Enlightenment.
As if this Enlightenment somehow, I don't know, dropped out of the sky.
So they're told that the Quran is the inerrant word of God. So the only way it can happen is if they stop believing in it, which I hope they will, but it's harder.
Right. Well, Christian.
So the Enlightenment happened because people stopped believing, or what was that process like? Gosh, I wish someone had written stuff down during that period. I don't know, Voltaire, maybe.
I can say that too, sort of. But they reinterpret the passages.
Oh, it's all metaphorical,
well,
here, symbolic.
You know, John 3. Yeah, right. Yeah, you talk about that in your book. Right. This is what this really means. You know, when Jesus said this, he really meant it's okay for gays to marry. Oh, really? Is that what he meant? Because 10 years ago, that's not what you said he meant. Yes, you know.
There we go. It's a shame that Christians change their interpretations, even when they change the interpretations the way we like it.
So theists will make the argument, for example, that, well, it was the Quakers and Samuel Wilberforce that were opposing the slave trade. So that's, you know, one point for Christianity. Yes, but almost everybody in opposition to the Quakers were Christians. They were.
That's because you don't have any, or at least not very many, atheists to point at who you can actually look at and say, well, here was the atheist vanguard convincing England and America to abolish slavery. Where was the atheist vanguard? Where were they? They were the ones in charge and power. It just incoherent.
For what we would call evangelicals, Protestants and Catholics, they were totally in favor of the slave trade. So it really came late. And you can see it with the gay marriage debate, because all religions were absolutely opposed all the way up until around 2011, 2012. When it began to shift, and then 2015, the Supreme Court made its decision to legalize gay marriage. And
now, remember where I said to put that flag? Oh, it's in Christendom where we have hope. Oh. So, but isn't all of this still coming out of Christendom? Isn't the nations of Christendom who are trying to twist the arms of the other nations of the world to adopt a Western, liberal, progressivist fight for gender equality or the abolition of the sexual binary?
And then most religions said, all right, I guess, you know, we'll have to reinterpret those passages. You know, so they get there. So that's encouraging. I mean, I don't think we have to, you know, hope for the absolute dissolution of all religion, because it obviously serves people other personal purposes. But just
there's, you know, somebody on Twitter asked me about, you know, Peterson and God number one and God number two. And I said, he's a modernist. And what Shermer just articulated there is the classic modernist thing. And if you go back through the archives of Unbelievable and see Richard Dawkins on Unbelievable, basically the argument is always, you can have any faith you want, just don't vote because of it. Oh, in my question and answer, I was asked about politics and religion, and I talked about Jesus and John Wayne in that book. And I, you know, the problem with religion and politics is that they use the same spectrum, and they're so close and so tight. Your politics and argon is your religion's going to affect your politics. I can't just keep it at home. It's people don't work that way.
As long as you have a secular government where they can't impose their values on other citizens.
secular government where they can't impose. Well, what do you think legislatures are made of? But people who are voting their view of morality and a preferred future and asking their representatives to promote that in the public square.
Of different faiths or no faith. That's the key, I think. But Islamic states don't have those kind of constitutions like we have.
Gosh, I wonder what kinds of people wrote that constitution, what kinds of backgrounds they had. Now, again, you can go back and, you know, you can, I thought there was an excellent book, Faiths of the Founding Fathers, a lot of deists, but, you know, George Washington went to church, Ben Franklin had very interesting ideas about religion. They didn't look like these guys. So I got annoyed and I got on Twitter, which probably isn't always the smartest thing to do. And I just, being a pastor, thought of a whole bunch of metaphors. It's like the guy coming back from a California reservoir with a glass of water declaring, "We absolutely must not get our water from the clouds." And you just want to say, the water in your glass got in the reservoir from the clouds. That's how it got there. He imagines his support for gay marriage was cooked up in some Christianity-free clean room. I suppose his immune system is so strong because it never met a germ. Where'd my other tweets go? I write these things down so I can remember them. In some ways, their ignorance of history, of how history works, parallels creation ex nihilo. That's enlightenment ex nihilo. Only someone who doesn't know Voltaire could imagine, he said, "And let there be godlessness, and it was evening and morning the first day." Voltaire had a sense of a god, but, I mean, just read the Enlightenment thinkers. They're sort of all over the map with respect to many of these ideas. All of this is while they say things like, well, religion might disappear from Christendom, but not from the rest of the world. They haven't had the Enlightenment. But again, the Enlightenment was done in a Judeo-Christian, in a Judeo-Christian clean room. I mean, why would you think that? This is like saying water has nothing to do with life as we know it, but we strangely only seem to find life where we find water. So all of these things you value are only found downstream from Christianity, but that's purely accidental, random, and absolutely disconnected. And then I linked in this video where, I mean, in Arrested Development, there's this ongoing, Tobias keeps saying the most outrageous things that, and all of his actions and behaviors, well, he's gay. And so at one point, Michael, his brother-in-law, says, "I wish you'd just tape yourself and listen to the things you say, and maybe you can understand why we think what we think about you." And so finally, at the end, Tobias takes out the recorder, tapes himself, and nope, can't see it. That seems to be these guys. That's a very different thing from what I find from these guys, from Chris Williamson, from Rebel Wisdom, from John Vervaeke. They at least sometimes somehow have a knowledge that this is one. Now there's many, many branches, obviously. We're all sort of working things out, but they're sort of doing it outside the church, but in some ways similar. Now, why? I know for some of my audience, some of you are anxious to hear me say more about the rise and fall of Mars Hill and to really do a dive into parts of that. And some of you will be like, why are we going to talk about this? Because actually it has everything to do with the projects of Rebel Wisdom and Chris Williamson and John Vervaeke. 50% of people who go to church in America go to 10% of the churches. Well, think about that. Not 10% of the denominations. 10% of the churches. part of the argument that Wellman and his colleagues are going to make in High on God is that megachurches are successful. They work for Americans, and they actually work for a very broad span of Americans who they're different from a lot of the audiences of these channels for a lot of reasons, but they scale in terms of IQ. They scale in terms of socioeconomic things. They scale in a variety of ways. They don't scale completely, but megachurches are a big deal. And part of what's interesting early in Wellman's book is he actually gets into a lot of the cognitive science around religion. And that's going to be interesting. And maybe at some point I've sent Wellman an email, and I hope to have him on the channel. I think a conversation between him and John Vervaeke would be fascinating. I'd love to see John Vervaeke look at Wellman's book. And I'm sure, because they're both academics, there would be plenty of critique, and you know, it's just kind of the path of academia. But I'd be really curious to know what Vervaeke thinks of the cognitive science that's done in the High on God book. Now, the other 50% of American churchgoers love to complain about the megachurches. Is it envy? Is it fear? Because I talk to any of my church planters, everybody, including myself, have lost wonderful members to megachurches. Because, well, you're at Living Stones. Well, do we have this big production for music? Do we have this big production for holidays? Do we have a nice consumer buffet of options for every need and desire? In my experience, when people leave small and medium-sized churches, if they keep going to church, most of them will transition into a megachurch. And megachurches have been sucking up people from smaller churches for a long time. I think that's part of the reason you hear a lot of resentment and complaint about the megachurch. And in The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill, they're going to go into some of those dynamics, but I've got some critiques about some of those dynamics. Megachurch Christianity is a huge form of conservative Christian ecclesiology in America right now, and it's not slowing down. And for a lot of the reasons given in his book, it works. Now, what's interesting about that in the light of channels like Chris Williamson and Rebel Wisdom and the Stoa and John Vervaeke's work is that's sort of the metric. Does it work? Well, work to what? Well, a lot of the metrics in High on God are not disconnected from the metrics I hear in... See, I don't want to... They're not really... Let's just say these self-improvement efforts outside the church. And as I said in the video where I treated and I commented on Williamson and Rebel Wisdom's conversation, you know, they ended with community. And yeah, I agree. Again, it's this, they're in some ways, they're sort of reinventing a lot of what the church has developed over centuries. I stumbled across, boy, the YouTube algorithm's been very interesting to me lately. I stumbled across a new channel called Ready for Harvest, which is done by sort of a church wonk. And I like a lot of his videos. They're very clear. They're very informative. They boil things down. It's kind of like Christian denominations for dummies. Okay. And I don't mean that pejoratively. There's that dummy series book that takes an enormous amount of complexity and, well, breaks it down into some memorable chunks, which are, of course, if you're breaking down complexity, you're losing nuance, but you're getting a degree of clarity and you're affording some contrast. And that's what he did. In this particular video, Church Denominations with McDonald's Level Dominance, it's a fascinating video where he goes through a little metric to try to figure out what kind of church you can find just about everywhere. And they sort of span certain things. You've got Catholic, you've got mainline, you've got evangelical, and it's very interesting. Now, what he doesn't go into is whether those particular groups might be thriving or declining. And I had a conversation with a colleague last week, a rather depressing conversation, where basically we were looking at the churches in our classes, and I think this is true over the entire Christian Reformed denomination for the most part, and there are some definite important exceptions. Rural and churches in agricultural communities, Christian Reformed churches in those communities are doing quite well. Christian Reformed churches in urban areas are struggling, and in some cases struggling a lot. You know, my church is struggling. Christian Reformed churches in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, are a number of them are, you know, seriously considering just plain closing. Some of them have enough money, but they've got so few people. You get to a point of, well, what's the point? Especially when in living memory, they had lots more people. So there's a lot going on. And so this whole question of, you know, this little tautology, you know, that which endures continues. Well, of course. But it's sort of that way. And so you have these changes work very slowly. And again, some of the Pew research about the nuns and the duns, some of these changes have happened very quickly. But because we're measuring in our lifetimes and people live 70, 80, 90, 100 years, there's a certain clock speed to all of this. Will these efforts amount to anything? And again, this little video clip that I'm one of the few clips when I was working on my clip channel of Ross Douthat talking about the fact that if Marianne Williamson had lived in the 19th century, she would have started a church. And whereas churches, you know, do rise and fall, open and close, increase and decrease, what established communities do is slow down both the process of acceleration, but especially the process of decay, and leave their impact. It's hard to know, apart from YouTube or books, what the long-term impact of Rebel William, Chris Williamson, or John Vervaeke's work will be. Very difficult. While I impact the church, so my impact might not be as dramatic as theirs is, I'm impacting a community that is in many ways more durable. And part of the reason I think we notice churches through time is that, again, without individuals, nothing changes. Without institutions, nothing endures. If you want to build something that will have a long-lasting impact and actually a hope of maybe thriving, whether or not your time has come, build an institution. I mean, Jordan Peterson bloomed in a very dramatic way, but, you know, by virtue of what he spent his time on between 2013 and 2018, who knows if anybody will be talking about him in 2025. But you found a church, well, we're still talking about Joseph Smith or Mary Baker Eddy or Augustine, Aquinas, Paul of Tarsus, David, Moses. And as I've said before, Jesus wouldn't be Jesus without the church. John the Baptist made a very big splash a couple of centuries, but where's John the Baptist? Jesus still going strong. Why do we know the name of Muhammad? Why do we know the name of Buddha? So a lot of people have been pontificating about the end of religion. Well, I suppose if you define it in a certain way, maybe it looks promising. But again, look at Clay Routledge's work and what most people have noticed, religion isn't going away. It's changing. And there are upsides and downsides. And the megachurch, again, that's a startling number. 50% of American churchgoers go to 10% of America's churches. There are reasons for that. And so we're going to have to get into them. The Rest is History podcast did an episode on the Beatles, which I wish was 10 times as long as it was. And in the comment section, if you have good resources, books, videos, movies on the Beatles, link them in there. I'm really curious. One of Tom Holland's contentions, and I think he's right, is that I think few of us would argue it. You know, the decade from 1965 to 1975, hugely substantive. And Tom Holland thinks that, you know, we call the Reformation in hindsight, in the 1510s, nobody was thinking that way. People didn't understand the consequence of everything that was happening. And one of the books that Tom, and he told me when I did my interview, and you can find that on the channel, one of the books that he told me he's looking forward to write is a book on that. And I'm very much looking forward to reading that book. And so I've been thinking a lot about music. And if you follow me on Twitter, you know, I've been swapping music stuffs with Paul Ann Leitner and Sarah and Tripp and others on Twitter. And the subject of the Monkees came up. And the Monkees are interesting because, you know, some people called them the prefab four, because the Monkees were completely an invention of Hollywood's desire to capitalize on the huge capitalization that was happening with the Monkees and the British invasion of rock music. And there's a little tidbit in one of the videos on the history of the Monkees that the Monkees sold more records in 1967 than the Beatles and the Stones combined. Now, if you know anything about the Monkees and their early success, all of those songs were chosen by a producer. They were produced by studio musicians and vocalists and, you know, a lot of lip syncing going on. And eventually, the four that were chosen to be the stars of the show of the Monkees, two of them were actors and two of them were musicians. And, you know, not very long into the production, the two musicians were in full rebellion and the two actors were like, huh? We're making huge money, boys. For the actors, this is exactly what they wanted. They were playing the parts of a rock band on TV. The musicians wanted to be the Beatles. And this is where we get, again, back into... it's... you guys and your diversity. The inclusion and diversity of my channel is so astounding because... you know, that you've got the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics and, you know, the post-Christians and, you know, all the span that you guys are. Megachurch isn't a church. The megachurch are a blight. 50% of American churchgoers go to 10% of its churches. What is a church? How are we to think about these things? And it was interesting because in some ways, the Monkees TV show was MTV before there was MTV. Were they a real band? Well, then they tried to be a real band with some of the music that a couple of them had been making, and they didn't reach the heights that they had reached in 1967. And when I say the Monkees, and some of you who are old enough have some songs that start going off in your head, those weren't the ones written by the musicians that were in the band. Those were the ones selected by the Hollywood producer, chosen from professional songwriters, played by studio musicians. There's a really cool video out there about, you know, who's writing all the hit songs today? Swedes. ABBA just released a new single. I definitely want to release this after I release my conversation with Drew about music as apologetics. We're going to be wrestling with platforms. What is a church? What is personal growth? What is witness? What is the goal? What is the good? What is this world for? It's going to be interesting. Thanks for watching.